So welcome again. Welcome once more. So we are exploring the birthing of the heart. I hope people feel that this is relevant. It's a gentle series, really, on the shifting of energy from mind to heart, and to give some encouraging ways to do that, and also some structural difficulties that create a hesitation or a fear along the way. And so a part of the encouragement of this series is for us to actually act from the heart as our intention for the weeks that intervene between our meetings, so that the homework takes on a kind of a crucial element, because the heart really needs our action to foster and encourage its manifestation, its totality. And always waiting in the background is our conditioned reference and how we would do it if we were operating under the mind. And so it takes a certain daring for us to explore this new avenue. And I'll talk a little bit more about that tonight. But I want to start with a daring statement, if I could. Partially to shock, but mostly to get your attention and to orient us very quickly and suddenly to the direction that we are taking. And that statement is that we are not someone on our way to becoming no one. So just let that set with you for a second. We are not someone. That's not the path of the practice. We're not someone on the way to becoming no one. Pause. We are already no one. Now, that's crucial. It's crucial in every facet of the practice. Because most of us keep reflecting and asserting our something, our someoneness, and missing the emptiness that is intrinsic to this mind and body. And what this series is meant to do is to shift the balance so that we begin to sense that wonder that's always available to us, and to start questioning the certainty of our someoneness. Usually how people practice is just the opposite. They really believe in their someoneness, and they think that somehow over the course of many years of practice they'll suddenly have some kind of an experience that will take them to nothingness. But when you practice as someone, you can be assured that the conditioning of that someone will maintain its proper orientation all along the way throughout your practice. And even though there may be glimpses of the emptiness that is intrinsically there, still it will be quickly shielded from the someoneness that we believe ourselves radically to be. And the belief in that someoneness overshadows whatever experiences we might have along the way. But in fact, being no one is our present disposition. So as a follow-up to that declaring sentence, let me just have you sit with your nothingness and see how ill-disposed you are, how awful it seems, how terrifying. You're already that. Now, if you're already that, in fact, why would you fear becoming that? And how terrible could it be to realize that if, in fact, we're already there to begin with? You see, we build the terror, the fear, from the idea of being someone and then becoming no one. And then we think there must be a cliff I have to go off and fall and falter, when it's nothing like that at all. The difference between the realization of the nobody we are and the someone we think we are is that we keep referencing the noise that our mind is making to certify the logic of that someone. We stabilize ourselves within the conditioning of our thinking. And there we sit very comfortably, seated, knowing that we're someone because we hear ourselves speak. We hear ourselves think. That proves it, doesn't it? It proved it to Descartes. And it proves it to us. Now what if we just, yes, you can, you're never going to get away from the sound of your own thought. But there's a vast silence that spreads throughout the corridor of this mind, this noisy little mind. And if we just shifted our attention so that it not wasn't solely directed towards the thinking, but included, embraced the silence as well as the thinking, but also the silence that surrounds the thinking, we'd have a very different idea and assumption about our present orientation, our present personhood. But see that we don't do that. We keep referencing the silence, and we keep referencing the noise, and that noise becomes spiritual noise. It starts talking Dharma to you. Have you noticed that? And starts encouraging you dharmically. And many people feel like that's a better sound than the sound of their own history. But it's still sound, and it's still certifying the sense of orientation of someone being here, using Dharma to end that someoneness. I just think it's essential, you know, especially as we transpose the word someone and no one into the language that we're using in these classes, which is the heart and mind. So said from that slant, we are not the mind waiting to become the heart. That's an easier access for many people because it feels closer somehow. And yet it's exactly the same words, just used from a different phrase. But the idea then, you can get a sense that the heart is available to us. And again, it's because we keep referencing the narrative, the commentary, the noise of the conditioned references of ourselves that keep us from fully participating in the heart. And yet here lies the heart. Cannot be disturbed because it cannot leave us. But we can disturb it by not wanting or being willing to listen to it. So this is the key element when we talk about moving our action so that it's aligned with the quality of being nobody, or said from the heart, the quality of the heart. Because the conditioning of ourselves, the noise we make, the thoughts we think, the references and the knowledge we have about everything, that's our stabilization. That's how the mind stabilizes itself. That's how the somebody gets a feeling of itself being someone, is because it knows where it's been and it knows where it's going. And so as long as I can look backward and have a history and look forward and have a future, then the present takes care of itself within that. And so the stabilization, the mental stabilization, is around our conditioning, what we know. So when we're moving in this class toward the heart, birthing the heart, we have to have a period of time in which we are destabilized. Because conditioning will just keep referencing itself. It will just keep reinforcing itself. And so we have to have a sense, and this is the fear component of it, of stepping out of our conditioning, stepping away from our conditioning, stepping through our conditioning, is better said, rather than just constantly following that conditioning. How do we do that? We do that most predominantly through our actions. Not just through our desire to do it, because desire is another expression of the conditioning mind. By standing up to the conditioning that is there, by taking a stand to it, by feeling the need to the usual way I do things and decide to do something different. Driving the same way to Sims every week, I'm going to take a different route. Knowing only the same people in the Sangha, I'm going to meet new people. Thinking only these assumptions about myself, I'm going to arrest the need to think in that way and to bring forth a different attitude, inward attitude, or disposition. To take action against the conditioning way that keeps us contracted, stabilized within ourselves. This word contraction is the word really that I think best indicates someone very tightly wound in their mental frame of reference, going about their life in the usual and normal and predictable way. The word openness or inclusiveness, which I'm going to use tonight, for me represents an altercation to that new usual and normal condition. Openness. Now that there's a tension, you can feel it, between the word openness and the word contraction. You can see why we stay contracted, you know. Like it just clamps you down. It holds you in place. It solidifies everything immediately. Now it's interesting, in physics, in quantum physics, I think I mentioned this in another talk, but because I don't understand it, I'll keep mentioning it. In quantum physics, an object is not an object until it is perceived in consciousness. It is a wave of possibilities. Once it's perceived, it becomes only what it's known to be. That's contraction. Perceiving, knowing, solidifying around what I've always known that thing to be, including myself, more especially myself, as opposed to a wave of possibilities. To start moving with the wave of possibilities means I start giving myself other options, other possible ways to move, other possible forms and expressions in which to move. I open up the possibility of wonder, of maneuverability and flexibility. Knowing that the counter that, the mind will induce fear. Because when you start to step out of yourself and away from the mental frame and knowledge that we have within the certainty of the knowing that we hold, the mind loses its contraction. It loses its certainty. It loses its affirmation. And we sense a sense of wonder. We feel a sense of wonder. But the mind recoils within that wonder with a fear response, trying to get us back to the contracted state of one-pointed determination. So I'd like to throw out a question for you to hold this week. And just from time to time, it's a koan for you. Koan is a question that seems confusing. But if you stay with the koan, and you just let it settle without being too upset by not having an immediate explanation, you'll sense that it has a welcoming component to it and starts bringing you deeper into itself. And so the question I would like to pose: what is alive but has no story? What is alive? See, I know what's alive and has a story. I can answer that one if some... Me. Me is my answer. Right? But what's alive and has no story? To claim yourself to be you, you have to claim your story along with it. But as I began tonight's talk, I'm asserting that you're more than that. And therefore the story, although part of the description of events and functionality of the world we live in, isn't the total story. In fact, it's the smallest component of the story possible, of the totality of the picture. It's like taking the period at the end of a paragraph and claiming the whole paragraph is composed within that period. So though, although there is a way to listen to ourselves through the story, there's also a way to be present within the silence that surrounds that story. What's shocking about that? What's shocking about taking a picture that you've held up in front of your face for your entire life and just taking it back about 5 feet so that you begin to see a greater perspective than just what it looks like up close? And as we do so, like a Monet painting, the scene of the painting begins to make sense once you have separated yourself some feet from it. And so too our life begins to make sense in a way it never did when you bring the silence in around the noise rather than just keep asserting the track of the noise. The noise keeps convincing you that if you keep following the noise, an end is in sight. It says, wait, you aren't ready yet, but soon you will be, and when you are, this is what you can expect, and it has the knowledge base to tell you what you can expect, as if it's ever seen what it's like outside of its noise, which it never has. So how could it possibly expect to know what it could not possibly be perceived? And so we have to take the step, the unusual step. And it's the probably 90% of the spiritual journey, in fact, has to do with a deep questioning around the noise of our life, the mental frame of reference that we have given everything. To begin to see how we conditionally label in order to identify and stabilize events externally and internally. At the sake of a greater wonder, which is everything really. So to start taking on, okay, so I see that there is an intrinsic contradiction and tension between opening, which means opening through the conditioning, and contraction, which means stuck within the conditioning. And I see how I do that. The first thing is just to get the lay of the land, to get a sense of how we keep certifying ourselves. You don't have to try to shove the noise away. In fact, that's not a recommended method. But simply get a sense of the lay of the land around us. Get a sense of the topography of how we keep contracting. How we, for instance, selectively listen. It's very interesting. Sit down with your partner who, if it isn't a new partnership, you know what they're going to say long before they say it. And so you're selectively listening to what you know they're going to say. And just see that conditioned phenomena of how we have discounted the person in order to gain the traction of the stabilization, the rigidity of the knowing. Therein lies the heart. How can you dismiss someone and expect it to be heartfelt? How can you not listen, which is the connecting influence that each of us have, the optimal one, and expect to be interconnected? And expect the heart, which is the source of interconnection, to come into play? And yet somehow, we just don't think we need to do that. We need to sit, yes, but we don't need to listen. You see? But I'm saying tonight that this is the action that's required. There are actions that are required to change this tendency around, to reverse the reinforced way we keep mentally referencing anything so that we can allow the heart some space to actually be able to see. And of course there's judging and all the opinionation that we have, all of which, again, just are meant to stabilize the unit. If I know, okay, I've listened to you and I've listened to you, and now I know, right? And then within that, there's the liberal knowing, right? Because I'm open-hearted, I feel for the poor and the disadvantaged. And when these people talk, I don't have to listen to them because they don't know. And when these people talk, I want to listen to them because they really are in line with my point of view. And so we selectively listen, often from our political persuasion. In fact, a story I've told before, but I'll tell again. In hospice care, I was the director, and we got an invitation from a very conservative Christian organization to care for one of their patients. But the compromise they would like was that they would provide all of the volunteer support, and we would provide the skilled services, the skilled caregivers. So I said, okay, well, that sounds fair to me. I'll bring it to the team, which consisted of, you know, nurses and social workers and chaplains and volunteer coordinators and home health aides, etc. And there were probably about 50 or 60 staff, and I said to them, okay, so here's the proposition, here's the proposal. They'll provide the volunteer support and we'll provide everything else. And then I told them who the group was, and everybody recalled, said, no, we don't want any part of that. We don't want any part of that. I said, well, why don't you want any part of that? They said, every time we get into a home where they're a part of the family or a part of the greater network within that home, they try to convert us. And I said, are you afraid of being converted? They said, I don't care, we're just not going to do it. I said, no. Hospice fundamentally is about opening to all points and persuasions, to all people, regardless of their dispositions. Now, are you saying 95% of them are okay, but these 5% aren't? I'm the director, and I find that intolerable. Right? But you can see, you know, that we can so selectively identify with certain kinds of speech that we listen to those parts that are in alignment to what we want to hear. And each of us have that. And shut out and completely dismiss anything that's counter to that opinion. Because we know, right? Because we know. So here's something you can also consider this week. Another koan for you. That all opinions are equal. What? What do you mean all opinions are equal? You have to take that to a level not of right or wrong, which is where we like to take it, but you have to take it as what is the force behind an opinion? How does it develop within someone? And if you lived within a certain frame of reference, you too would have a very different opinion. In fact, it's that need to constantly right or wrong something that keeps us away from the heart. You can be sure if you are selecting out certain parts that you think are okay and others that are not, that's the mind that's in operation in that moment, not the heart. The heart does not select like that. In fact, Rumi said it this way. He said, beyond our ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the spirit lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make sense anymore. You see, it's a change of paradigms. It's a change of dimension we're talking about here. And that change of dimension does not go through the logic of the mind. It doesn't go through the consolidation of view. It doesn't go through the right and wrong of our character. It doesn't go through the programming of our history. And there's only one thing that can do that, not your narrative or your commentary or your story, because that has been formed by your history. But the silence that contains that and expands far beyond it. Now, when we sit, we are sitting in silence. We aren't, hopefully, just following every thought as it comes up and reoccurs to ourselves. We are relaxing sufficiently so that there's some breadth, some space around the thought. So the thoughts are heard, but the space is really the relief from the conditioning that we have engendered. And that's where the value of meditation lies. It doesn't lie in straightening out your thinking. It lies in giving space to your thinking, to giving a little bit of room to whatever reactions we have to each word we're saying, so that everything is followed to the exact detail of each thought. It's the space that provides the stress reduction, provides the benefits that you read about for meditation practice. Now, what happens is that for most of us, when we reach a certain point, when we no longer trust what our mind is telling us, that takes a while, takes a lot of attention to thought and questioning about thought. But you can start with some of the obvious ways that thought takes us and deviates from the norm. Just take some of your outrageous inward speech, your outrageous thoughts. Where did that come from? Everyone hates me, right? I'll never meet another person like him. For the rest of my life, those kinds of things that are so outrageous, so distorted that you can actually laugh when you say them because they're so obviously untrue. Take those thoughts and start bringing it down a little more into the ones that are seem to make sense until they're scrutinized, and then they fall apart under your awareness and gaze. And you, as you start looking at thought, you'll see that each thought is an opinion in and of itself. And there's a basic way that when we divest from energizing thoughts, that energy then goes into the space that surrounds the thought. And then the space takes over our attention. And it provides much clearer reference. Instead of being afraid of not thinking, because what am I going to do if I can't think? You continue to think. No one takes that away from you. You just don't have the energy to keep it going like you used to. That's the only thing that's different. You've just divested energy from it. You haven't thrown it out. And it's there when you need to use it, but it'll be at the command of the space rather than at the command of the previous thought. And so when this space begins to open, now you have more ability to be able to discern what it is that's going on and what it is that you want to believe and follow and what you don't. And that discernment follows the space. More space, more discernment. Less mental referencing, more discernment. More mental chatter, less discernment, but more logic. More rational thought. So you move this way, you get that. You get universities and certainty. You go this way, you get ministers and chaplains and spiritual seekers. So the willingness to be quiet in ourselves, the willingness to begin to open, the willingness to use openness for our disposition in life. Okay, so just for the intention. Maybe when you're lying in bed before you get up, today let me meet circumstances with openness, with a new openness. Instead of just my usual, kind of pinball machine attitude, just bouncing off of one thing. Let me just meet today, the expression of the day with openness, with an open intention. And we can use confusion and defensiveness as a cue to turn in that direction rather than away from that direction into contraction. So that when I'm doing something and I'm sort of outside my norm, outside of my usual and normal, my ordinary way I do something, when I'm taking a different direction to work than I've always taken, I start feeling a little agitated inside. I don't know my way. You know, why do you ever suggest this? God, I don't know my way. Take that as a cue that you're moving in a wise direction. Not that you have to get back, that you made a mistake and you have to get back on your old street. And sometimes that irritation can reach a kind of boiling point where you can see how it is that you're held within the straitjacket of your conditioning. And it's worth knowing that. Perhaps you will go back and ride the old streets to work the next day. But you'll know something about yourself. You'll know how you have held yourself within a kind of caged life. And that serves its own intention and purpose. Because as you start feeling the conditioned bars, the ways that it has controlled us and is controlling us, the spirit of the heart starts to venture out. It says, and there's a kind of resolution of heart that wants to break out of that jail, that's looking for the jailbreak. And we'll keep probing and finding access points so that that can happen. It's fun to do it. If we don't get lost in, you know, I don't want to become nothing. I'm not doing this. Okay, so you're not becoming nothing because you already are nothing. You're just finding and developing and seeing what you already are. That's all we're doing. So there isn't some great, huge, you know, haunted castle at the end of this thing. Right? It's already happening to you now. So it's over. And yet there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of work to do to prove it to ourselves. There's a lot of work to do to rest comfortably within the wonder and the silence that surrounds us at all times. Because there are two ways that we usually move through a life of change. And both of them appear to be ways that we are moving into more openness, more allowance, more inclusiveness. The first is by adapting. So, we're doing something and suddenly we have to change in a certain way. Say we get a new boss at work. Well, we think, well, maybe I could just quit. I'm almost retirement age. I could just quit and to hell with him. I don't need to. Okay, so that's the conditioning that says I don't have the strength to have to change into a new relationship at this stage of my life. I'm tired. So that's the contraction. But adaptation says, okay, well, let me just see what he's like. And maybe I can adjust a little bit to fit what he wants of me, even though it's not going to be the same as my old boss. Maybe I can do that. And so there's this kind of trying this and then seeing if it works, and then trying something else and seeing if that works. And it's a little bit, you know, two steps up, one step back, three steps back, two steps up, like that sort of thing. And that's how, if we have to change, the usual way that we do it. We usually do it through adaptation. Now adaptation, and I say this gently, is a mental frame of reference. It looks at what's worked, it looks at the possibilities of trying that in the present situation, it rationally looks and sees whether that's going to work, it says, well, maybe I have to modify a little bit, and then it tries that, and that does work, and then that becomes my new conditioning. And that's how we kind of navigate a new line for ourselves and whatever we're adapting to. So my suggestion is that that is not the shift of the paradigm that's necessary. The shift of the paradigm, of the dimension that's necessary, is not adaptation. It's surrender. It's releasing the need to have to adjust. It's simply moving in accordance. It's the definition of flexibility. It's moving in accordance to the circumstances of the present. It's doing what's appropriate in the circumstances of the present. You see what's there, you move and you're moving constantly. It's a constant fluidity. It's a constant state of motion, in the sense that it's not a set description or a tied down reaction. And therefore it never sets itself up in a kind of conditioned pattern or map for ourselves. I'm not saying that's easy, but the difference between that and the mental adaptation is the difference between thinking we're somebody and working our somebody out to become nobody, adaptation, or understanding from the beginning that we're nobody and proving that to ourselves. Surrender isn't all that hard. You just don't dispute what's going on. It's what is necessary in this moment. It's the action that's necessary in this moment. You take it, that's all. So it's aligned with spontaneity and creativity rather than for a determined result. The reason that we pull back from words like spontaneity is that we don't feel like there's a driving controller there. There's nobody at the wheel of the car. It's like one of these Google cars. I don't know if I'll ever get in those things because there's no one driving. That's kind of what we have to do in the Dharma, is get in the back seat and just say, well, this is faith. I don't know. And it's the surrendering of our objectives and our objections that allows that surrender to take place wholeheartedly. So I've given you a number of clues or cues for changing our action in the course of this week together. I want to do that, and I want to do that regularly. I want to encourage slight movements and flexibility, and vulnerability, and openness, innocence. Because these are the words that actually move us into the disposition of the heart. Flexibility, just being able to shift and move to what circumstances call for. Innocence. Coming into a situation without a predetermined way to be in that situation. Wonder. Keeping the sense of space and openness always in front of your eyes. Like right now. The wonder that's in this room. I speak to wonder. If you happen to hear it, that's great, but that's not who I'm addressing. It's much more fun. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? See, when we open ourselves up to the wonder that we are, then you see perceptually that wonder. It doesn't stay just with your own self-reference. It opens up to everything. Knowing that we are a heart already and not a mind on its way to becoming a heart, we can fulfill our promise through actions of the heart. Even before we have fully realized that fact, Nisargadatta Maharaj, one of my teachers in India, as I was dialoguing with him day after day, he says, you know, you can keep talking like this and we could go on for centuries, or you can just change and just fall into where I am that I'm pointing. Unfortunately, I preferred the dialogue. Okay, so we have just a few minutes for any questions or comments that you might have. One thing I would ask is that if you come in, that you don't leave in the middle unless you have a bus or a ferry to catch, that you stay the entire time. So any questions or comments, anyone? Yes. That's a very famous poem. The Rumi poem, beyond our ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the spirit lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make sense anymore. The world is too full to talk about. I love that phrase because that's really the direct experience of space as opposed to the contraction that we are usually maintain in terms of our disposition of self. When words don't make sense anymore, that when you've questioned your thinking to the point where this is silly to follow just this constant monotone voice in me, this voice in my head. And with that understanding comes great space. The world is too full. Let me give you some help. Okay, she's talking about having a sort of an overwhelming emotion that floods you. You all know the flooding syndrome. She's just wondering what I'm saying in respect to how to work with that. And what I would do is that I would write down, I'm into this these days, so you're... to sort of take notes on what, don't try to do something with it, you know, or don't try to get rid of it, don't get upset about it, but be willing to take notes. Write down what you're feeling, the words, the sentences that you're using that certify your feeling is correct, the emotions that arise, the story that's in the background that plays through and into the emotion that leads to the thought. Notice how the thoughts build up the emotion, and then as the emotion reaches a crescendo, they also lead to greater thinking or more exaggerated thinking. So you're just getting down the basic ingredients of this terrain. Again, you're not trying to change it. You're not condemning or judging yourself for that. But you're getting a sense of what's going on. What's going on. And you're doing it through writing rather than trying to just see it. Because seeing it, you're going to get confused by what you're seeing. When you're writing it, what happens then is it, you know, in an hour, you can come back to it and sort of say, whoa, I was completely taken over and I had a lot of, I really believed what was going on. But when you read it an hour later, it's like, why did I ever act like that? Why did I ever say those things? All right? So you get a sense of time and what this particular logic that was so certain at one point is so uncertain at another. And just giving yourself some opportunities to perforate the certainty of your moods, especially your reactive moods. What's happening in there, and the key to it, is that you're actually bringing some objective awareness rather than just falling under its sway and then acting it out and pretending that you're bringing some objective awareness. If you're writing it down, the writer of those is actually being objective, right? It's like note-taking or like a cultural anthropologist. Like they're in a foreign country here of madness. This everybody's mad. Let me just get down how, why they're mad. Why are they all insane? Well, okay, right? So just any way to bring that into it, right? So start there and spend some time and then just read it over. But just don't take it, especially on the second reading. Just find some lightness with it. You know, it's like, oh, well, this is amazing that I was that certain of, right? And then you can play with it, but you have to be careful here. But you can play with it. You can say, okay, I'm going to try to get back into that same mood again right now. Let me bring up what happened. Oh, you know, and try to work yourself up into it. So you're playing with it, right? It's different energy. And although some of that will come up, there'll still be more lightness and you'll be able to smile a little bit at it. Right? Okay, good. Anyone else? Okay. I've shut you up. So we'll have announcements now.